Did those people trying to institute an international biodefense strategy in the form of a pandemic agreement suffer a blow last year when they failed, or just put off their victory until a later time? What trigger of fear will be launched the next time our masters try to get the public to succumb to the next so-called pandemic? What changes were made to last year's pandemic agreement that allowed it to finally get it approved this past month? Could the requirement under the agreement of enforcing the genetic sequencing of the new deadly viruses and posting them online lead to a new arms race in biological warfare? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we share the disappointing news in the eyes of some critics that a modified, watered-down version of the pandemic agreement was finally approved at the World Health Assembly last month, and the prospects for rights and national sovereignty moving forward. In our first half hour, we play an excerpt from a September 2024 interview with journalist and filmmaker James Corbett on last year's failure of the pandemic agreement, in which he successfully predicted the threat it represented would be approved sooner or later. And in our second half hour, we spoke to commentator Dr. Merrill Nass about what is still problematic about this year's approach to stopping apparently much more frequent pandemic calls in the years ahead. On this week's program, the WHO pandemic treaty is the new world health order, ending national sovereignty in 2025. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 6th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today, thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The sad reality is that so-called Canada exists by virtue of cooperation with Indigenous people. However, the terms of the cooperation were set using faulty promises and treaties, which allowed the settlers to make more than they were entitled to, resulting in colonialism and genocide toward the Indigenous people present. Let us strive toward reconciliation and reparations for past and present harms so that we begin to embrace mutual respect and partnership in the years ahead. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. The UK believes it can fight both Eurasian giants simultaneously. According to the Strategic Defence Review PDF, the British military needs to be ready for a conflict against not only Russia and China, but also North Korea and Iran. The assessment posits that London is faced with, quote, a new era of threat with drones, artificial intelligence, and other technologies changing the nature of warfare more fundamentally than at any other point in history, unquote. The document has around 140 pages and contains guidelines for the British military with a particular focus on the NATO-orchestrated Ukrainian conflict, the largest and most intense in the world since WW2. Moscow and Beijing were described as primary opponents, although the latter was formally deemed a, quote, sophisticated and persistent challenge, unquote. That comes from the article, UK's insane strategy of fighting Russia, China, and giving nukes to neo-Nazi junta, by Drago Bosnick, posted June 4th. The bill is sponsored by Jody Arrington, a war hawk from the Bush-Cheney era. His political contributors include Koch, Inc., and AIPAC. It is notable that so many politicians have been able to easily come and go in Ukraine without incident, but then AI does wonders when you need to create fake stage sets. While in quote-unquote Ukraine, Graham and Blumenthal both stepped across the line of the Logan Act by specifically engaging in political dialogue and government activities with a nation at war. When those comments crossed to tariffs and the imposition of sanctions and funding, they have overlorded OFAC and the Treasury. That comes from the article, the quote, Big Beautiful Bill, unquote. Another $60 billion for Ukraine, Senator Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal in violation of the Logan Act, by Helena Glass, posted June 4th. Did the president himself know about it? The official line is that he did not. However, that doesn't mean the U.S. government wasn't involved. As former CIA analyst Larry Johnson said Monday in an interview with Judge Andrew Napolitano, the U.S. government would likely strive to give the president plausible deniability for an operation like this, which took place some 2,700 miles inside Russia and away from the front lines of the ongoing war. In a NATO proxy war against Russia, with Ukraine serving as the proxy, somebody in Washington and or London had to have been involved in an operation as sophisticated and strategic as the one that went down in Russia on Sunday, Johnson said. That comes from the article, quote, 100% sure, unquote. CIA had some involvement in massive Ukrainian drone strike on Russian airfields, former CIA analyst, by Leo Homan, posted June 4th, originally published on Leo's newsletter. Truth, foundational to a global peace movement, may one day serve to create an international community capable of solving humanitarian catastrophes. But currently, truth and international community are both being subverted by a global hegemon, which is Washington. Of all the countries in the world, the U.S. is least suited to the role of leader of a, quote, new world order, unquote. Washington has made a mockery of international law, and any, quote, rules-based order, unquote, would be more of the same. The disasters in Palestine, in Syria, in Ukraine, and on, are evidence of this. That comes from the article, quote, New World Order, unquote, or, quote, New World Dictatorship, unquote, by Mark Taliano, posted June 5th.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
A year ago, the pandemic agreement failed to pass as a result of pushback from a significant portion of the public. I had a conversation with frequent guest James Corbett in which he indicated all we succeeded in doing was to kick the problem down the road to when the World Health Assembly or similar structure may have succeeded in getting most of or all of the disturbing parts of it approved. James Corbett, as I've indicated on the show before, is an award-winning investigative journalist and host of the Corbett Report at corbettreport.com. Here is a replay from our conversation, which aired in September of last year.
You had been following it for months, and there was a major popular resistance to the pandemic treaty. I mean, some people got your message. And as I understand it, there was a major demonstration put on by critics in Geneva, a Geneva convoy aimed at opposing the WHO pandemic treaty and the pandemic treaty that didn't get passed, at least not in a form that all of us recognized or expected. So at least a partial victory of sorts. But could you apprise us of what happened last May? And in your opinion, did the WHO just kick the pandemic treaty further down the road until later, or did the people successfully kick the WHO in the guts?
I suppose it is how you look at it, but I'm certainly not resting on my laurels or patting myself on the back or, oh, everything's done here. No, unfortunately, this is a war of attrition, and just because the worst didn't happen in Geneva in May does not mean that it's not an ongoing process. In fact, quite the contrary. We talk about the pandemic treaty not having passed, but really that's only because they weren't able to finalize and get all the I's dotted and T's crossed in time for that World Health Assembly. But they've just kicked it, as you say, kicked the can down the road to or later this year, potentially. They have talked about the potential of holding a special World Health Assembly later this year to rubber stamp whatever they come up with, or at the very, very least, next year at the next World Health Assembly, they will have a pandemic treaty ready. So unfortunately, all of that momentum and interest and enthusiasm amongst the freedom community, freedom supporting community out there, free humanity, they know how to take that energy and just divert it or cool it down or give people a sense of a victory so that they sit back on their laurels. And it is interesting, actually. You mentioned, for example, that Geneva convoy that was taking place, but from my perspective here in Japan, it's been amazing to see the pushback against the biosecurity agenda that's been taking place, and really gaining momentum in Japan, especially this year. We've had a number of remarkable events I was just writing about with regards to the Replicon vaccine, which is the self-amplifying mRNA vaccine, which is sort of an upgrade or downgrade, I suppose, depending on which way you're looking at it, of the mRNA vaccine platform, which is essentially all of the worst parts of the mRNA vaccine, but even worse because it also includes a replicase protein, which will then encode for more of the mRNA within your own body that then encodes the proteins like the spike protein or whatever else Big Pharma wants to have circulating around in your system. And so if you are concerned about the mRNA vaccines and what the effects they are having on the global population, you should be very concerned about the prospect of self-amplifying mRNA vaccines and the potential, although we don't really know all of the potential effects of this, because of course it is not a thoroughly studied technology. It is a brand new experimental medical technology that has already been approved for use here in Japan and is due at this point to start rolling out in the next few weeks when the fall COVID-19 vaccination program starts here in Japan. They are supposedly getting ready to start using the self-amplifying mRNA vaccines. This is very concerning, and thankfully the Japanese people are starting to really wake up about this en masse. We saw earlier in January a vaccine study group here in Japan of some prominent doctors who held a really remarkable press conference talking about the problems of the mRNA vaccines and the many, many effects that they are having on the population. We saw a massive rally against the WHO in April, which was then parlayed into an anti-WHO group here that's about protecting the Japanese population from the global biosecurity agenda and stopping what they are calling the third atomic bomb, the self-amplifying mRNA vaccines that they say the government is now preparing to drop on its own citizens. We've seen another rally that took place in Tokyo in May, tens of thousands of people, which featured a speech from a former Japanese minister, a cabinet minister, who is still a sitting parliamentarian, who talked about his own experience developing cancer after having received the vaccine and tying those two things together, saying that, and then actually apologizing to the public, saying that these vaccines should have been tested more, they've been rolled out inappropriately, they're having a horrible effect. Actually apologized to the Japanese public for it. Startling stuff. Just last month,
Did the media in Japan, are they promoting this stuff as well, or is it
well,
just?
just last month, NHK, which is the Japanese national broadcaster, the equivalent of the CBC, on its a popular morning program, aired an entire segment about mRNA vaccine side effects and things that have been happening to people, vaccine adverse events. Because, as they put it in their own broadcast, we've received thousands of requests from viewers out there. Thank you very much. So here's a presentation. So they laid out an entire presentation about the mRNA vaccines, talked to people who were suffering from adverse events. Just 2 days later, the current Minister of Health in the Japanese government, said on a pretty significant walk back from the safe and effective line that we've heard from every basically health ministry in the world, said that I can't remember the exact phrasing of this, so don't quote me on this, but it was something to the effect of, we cannot guarantee the safety. As to the safety of these vaccines, we can't speak to that. Something along those lines. Anyway, it was a remarkable walk back from the position we are expected to hold. And now next week, there is going to be an international COVID summit, which will include not only people from around the world flying in to give presentations and to interact with prominent Japanese doctors about this issue, but also they will be giving a parliamentary presentation at the Japanese parliament as part of a press conference that's happening. And there will be another massive rally in Tokyo coming up next Saturday on the 28th. So there's a lot of activity happening here, as you would expect in a country that is facing what they are calling the third atomic bomb.
Yeah, I mean, I was just wondering, because I know it sounds like the Japanese population is waking up way more than apparently the Canadian population. I mean, notwithstanding we've had certain people speaking up, but it's pretty much quashed by the mainstream media. Let's see. I think that maybe you could talk a little bit about looking at COVID-19 in retrospective as the dust settles, so to speak. Now the next pandemic that they've been talking about, it could just be around the corner. Now a month ago, the WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus announced an upsurge of Mpox in the Democratic Republic of Congo and a growing number of African countries, who said that WHO said it constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. And I think they the MVABN vaccine that just got added to the pre-qualification list, which is necessary for timely and increased access to communities in urgent need. It's going according to an emergency listing. As with COVID-19, no evidence was supplied regarding the virus's existence. It relies overly much on the RT-PCR test to detect it, which is really not good for diagnosis, as the Nobel Prize-winning inventor of RT-PCR announced. I mean, he's dead in 2019. But with this device, you can create a scare factor around the virus, making me think this could be COVID-19, the sequel, okay, the Mpox. It is apparent based on much of the reporting that I've done on the show, you've done on your show regarding the pandemic, that it played a role other than healing people. It seemed to have been an attempt to test a new vaccine, not for health, but for control, and for seeing just how far you can push against democratic principles and so on. I mean, getting the entire world to lock down, all of that stuff. So I'm wondering, what role do you think this Mpox virus will play? Is this a sequel to COVID-19? Is it maybe an off thing? Because I mean, what is similar and what is different about this latest pandemic scare, in your opinion?
Well, I think the similarities are obvious, as you point out, several of them already, and we see essentially with COVID-19, even preceding COVID-19, we see the template of how these types of pandemic scares will presumably continue to work until the public stops falling for them, which is to say PCR tests creating an appearance or a belief in a widespread phenomenon that is affecting public health. And for that reason, as we've already seen, they can lock you in your home, they can force you into quarantine, they can force you to use digital apps to scan your location, they can use contact tracing, et cetera, et cetera. The precedent has been set. Now it's just a question of finding the right trigger that will scare the public enough. And whether or not monkeypox, and I will continue to refer it to that way because I remember a year ago when that was what it was called, but I don't know if that is particularly going to be the one that will be the scamdemic sequel, But it certainly is a candidate, as is many others. In fact, I've always found it quite humorous that one thing that the WHO has been warning about is pandemic X, whatever. They literally say, well, what we, you know, it's just some sort of hypothetical thing. It could be anything. We don't know. But in the future, where there will be some sort of pandemic X, and this X thing will have these properties, and it will kill however many millions of people. And it's literally something they just made up. They're literally saying it's a hypothetical thing that we're just making up, but we should be prepared for it. So it is on its face ridiculous. But I think it shows the actual connection between so many of these different threads that we're talking about. Not only the biosecurity agenda, finally detailed as it may be, but also the broader agenda that's rolling out and how it connects in to that quest for world government, which I think is ultimately what all of this is really about. And we can see that, for example, from the UN Pact for the Future, the Summit for the Future that's taking place or is about to take place in New York, where they are going to be deciding on whatever they're going to be deciding on with regards to an emergency action platform that will give the Secretary General of the UN special emergency powers and whatever other authoritarian nonsense they are dreaming up, is just one part of that agenda. Another part is using the biosecurity scare to enact changes, for example, to the food supply. And if that sounds like a strange leap, well, here we go. How about in Canada right now, Bill C-293, that is Bill C-293, is currently making its way through the Canadian Senate. It is called An Act Respecting Pandemic Prevention and Preparedness, which is, of course, presumably all about how do we prevent the next pandemic, monkeypox or whatever that may be. And this has apparently been forwarded by a Liberal Party backbencher. It has already been approved in the House and is now making its way through the Senate. And apparently what this means is, given the wording, and I would suggest people go and actually read the context of Bill C-293 so they can see it for themselves. But it starts talking about regulating commercial activity to specifically prohibit any activities that may potentially give rise to some sort of pandemic in the future, including industrial animal agriculture. And it also then instructs the Minister of Agriculture to promote commercial activities that can help reduce pandemic risk, including the production of alternative proteins. And that phrase may not mean anything to people at the first level. What does that mean? Promotion of alternative proteins. Well, if you've been paying attention to the Eat the Bugs agenda, they want you to eat insects. That is going to be your new main diet staple in this new normal that they're trying to bring in on the neo-feudal plantation. You are going to be eating bugs. And part of that, they are calling it alternative proteins. It's a protein derived from, say, cricket powder and other such things that are now being approved for human consumption for the first time in the history of many the European medical or food and safety administration has just approved, for example, cricket protein to be sold for human consumption, etc. This is called alternative proteins, and now this is being embedded in Bill C-293 in the Canadian Parliament that's talking about pandemic preparedness. So we have to start eating bugs. I mean, this is how every aspect of this global agenda starts to interlock. And to a certain extent, it almost, I won't say gives the lie to, but shows how the WHO pandemic treaty and all of that, to a certain extent, is window dressing, because this, at the end of the day, is going to be enacted in every nation state's national legislature. And it's going to be passed as, for example, Bill C-293 in Canada and whatever Senate bill or whatever in the United States, et cetera, all around the world. National legislatures are going to be forwarding suspiciously similar looking pandemic preparedness bills that will have all of this, all of these tools for control. Another thing embedded in Bill C-293 is contact tracing, of course, because the government needs to be able to have the communications technologies and facilities to be able to know everyone you're interacting with all the time, so that in case you fall ill, well, they'll be able to track everyone you've been in contact with. And that power would never be abused by any government, surely. So again, you start to see how under the cover and pretense of a sufficiently ginned up scare, that gets the public worked up enough that they will give up their basic fundamental rights, the rights guaranteed under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, right? As long as you are scared enough to be able to willingly give up those rights, the government will come along and take them gladly. And unfortunately, again, this is not just a Canadian problem. This is a global problem. It is happening in country after country all around the world. It is happening right now. And until we stop giving away our basic rights in the event of any perceived threat, and most of these threats are complete ginned up nonsense, but even if there was a real threat, that still does not give the government the right to come in and completely control my activities and start telling me to eat the bugs and all of this other self-evident nonsense.
Yeah. In case you just joined us, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name's Michael Welch, and my guest is the investigative journalist and host of Corbett Report, James Corbett. James, on the subject of the Bill C-292 and other legislations that are going up in countries around the world, is there a negative in terms of people bringing forward things like, I don't know, something like ivermectin or anything else like that that's going to be was pushed as an alternative to the WHO treatment? Is there some inconceivable mechanism that's going to even more profoundly marginalize those alternatives?
Yes, but the real operative question is treatment for what? Because as you say, this PCR test is something that is really not fit for purpose for diagnosing anyone with anything. It is a tool that can be used to gin up the perception of some sort of pandemic. But was there really a pandemic? And of course, researchers like Denis Rancourt there in Canada have talked about and gone in deeply into the statistics surrounding the appearance or lack thereof of an actual pandemic threat that did or did not take place in 2020, 2021. And he came to the conclusion that there was not a pandemic event that took place just based on the statistics alone. And he's done a lot of important research on that. So really the question we should be thinking about is, well, is the response, the hysterical tearing down the fabric of our society response that we saw in 2020 and 21 really proportional to what we experienced in our actual lives? And if not, then what really happened there and why is it happening? And I think that gets probably closer to the point. I mean, yes, certainly people have talked about ivermectin and other ways of combating what these spreading pathogens, etc. And I am certainly not here to tell, I'm not a doctor, I don't play one on TV.
Neither am I.
People's personal health and the decisions they make, great, good for you. I'm sure you can do that better than I can do that for you. But having said that, I think the obvious, the 10,000 pound elephant in the room that cannot be discussed is that health is fundamentally prevention of illness. And prevention of illness involves being healthy, eating healthy, engaging in a healthy lifestyle, disentangling yourself from the glowing screen, going outside in the sunlight, grounding your feet on the actual earth, spending time in physical activity, all of these things that tend not to make money for major corporations and big pharma, etc., which is precisely why the prevention side of all of this is completely and utterly neglected. And the mantra of the mainstream establishment message over the past few years is, you got to get a needle in your arm. That is health. And once you have your needle in your arm, you know, anything. And the epitome of that particular nonsense was the giving away of free Krispy Kreme donuts. If you get your vaccination, you can get some donuts. You'll be doubly healthy. You'll have the experimental medical technology in your arm, and you'll have some donuts to clog your arteries with.
That was award-winning investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker James Corbett of the Corbett Report. His website is CorbettReport.com.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
On May 19th, member states of the World Health Assembly approved the Official Pandemic Agreement, a treaty that was intended to improve on perceived missteps of what was seen as the COVID-19 pandemic from 2020 to the present day. This time, representative countries hope to invoke mechanisms with a more scientific approach and sidestep inequitable treatment from place to place. However, many warnings were put out the last time we tried to shove the document through the UN's major health body concerned with public health. Most particularly, it would threaten national sovereignty, impose countermeasures, and censor what was called disinformation, meaning criticism, even science-based criticism of the techniques the body prescribed. The agreement did not pass in 2024, so it went back to the drawing board, and this time a modified version of the agreement was approved. We wanted a more detailed look at exactly what it was about the agreement that should concern us, so we talked to a favorite guest on this subject. Meryl Nass, MD, is an internal medicine physician and activist with expertise in anthrax and bioterrorism. Her interest is in prevention, investigation, amelioration, and safe and effective medical response. Her expertise and experience includes treating patients with Gulf War syndrome and adverse effects from the anthrax vaccine. She has raised cogent critiques about the deficient response to the recent Ebola outbreak, unfounded panic about a so-called measles epidemic, global vaccine safety issues, medical ethics, and corruption in the medical, industrial, military complex. She has provided testimony to 7 congressional committees, and her work has been mentioned in 25 books. Her websites are merylnass.substack.com and doortofreedom.org. Dr. Nass, welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour.
Great to be here and talking with you, Michael.
This new agreement that got passed at the World Health Assembly, could you maybe describe what is different about this pandemic agreement, which did get approved, as opposed to the last agreement in 2024, which did not get passed?
Yes, but in order to do that, let me give some background. So at the very beginning of the COVID pandemic, groups of Western nations and their leaders got together and decided that under the guise of preventing any more pandemics and having them managed properly, that pandemics of the future and biological warfare of the future would need a global response, a centralized response centered in the World Health Organization. Now, the World Health Organization is only funded 15% by dues from its member nations, and 85% is donations from pharmaceutical companies, philanthropies like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Wellcome Trust, and nations, most of which designate their donation to be spent on certain projects or certain products.
So are you saying it's basically a public-private partnership?
Yes. Basically, the World Health Organization is run by hidden hands that donate money, and it does their... So 75% of the activities that the World Health Organization performs are done for these private donors, and only 25% are actually initiated within the WHO and done for the member nations. And the UN has a similar organization. I'm not sure what percent of its expenditures are paid as dues. But in any event, the plan was back in end of 2020, 2021, that amendments to an existing agreement called the International Health Regulations and a new pandemic treaty would be developed that would provide the legal and administrative infrastructure to centralize control of public health globally. And they did this in a number of ways. They made the original versions of these two documents filled with orders. So in a treaty, when you say shall, it means you must. And so there were over 100 shalls in each of these draft treaties that nations must do this, must do that, must pass laws that the WHO tells them to pass in order to rapidly roll out drugs and vaccines in a pandemic, surveil their citizens in three ways. They had to, when they're told to by the WHO, so they have to swab their citizens in the event of a pandemic. They have to surveil the social media presence of their citizens so that they can clamp down and censor any non-WHO narratives that are going around the internet about the pandemic. And they had to make available their subjects' medical records so the WHO could evaluate them to see whether there was a new pandemic starting somewhere, if people in one region start coming down with a similar group of symptoms, that supposedly would help the WHO to identify pandemics early and jump on them before they got out of hand.
So basically what you're saying is it's not an, you know, they're not giving their advice. I mean, they're ordering you to do these things, right?
That's correct. So that was the original plan. And it couldn't get passed. You know, I think that perhaps those documents would have been accepted and adopted if the people of the world didn't really know what was in them. But my organization worked with a number of other organizations, and I traveled around the world. I spoke in 8 different parliaments, and and groups of activists around the world started having meetings and showing people what was actually in these documents, that your own country would no longer have sovereignty over health. But the WHO, whenever the director general made a declaration, would then take over public health for the world. And public health itself was expanded. So the World Health Organization, along with the Rockefeller Foundation and the Wellcome Trust, EcoHealth Alliance, and the US government, the British government, the Dutch government, and many others, had come up with this bogus concept called One Health. And One Health, the idea of One Health was to expand what public health really meant, and say that One Health had to do with the health of animals, plants, ecosystems, in addition to people. And so if the director general felt that there was a threat to an ecosystem or a climate threat or a gun threat or a smoking threat, he could then issue orders to ban, you know, private ownership of guns or smoking or gasoline-powered cars, things like that. So that was how these things were originally written, giving him this potential tremendous authority. And
so you'd basically be giving them the authority not just to make commands on health, but in a sense, you know, extend their reach to climate change or animals or all sorts of other, they're
exactly
extending their reach, right?
Extending their reach. So, you know, it's a clever idea. If you're a globalist and you want to obtain greater control over the people of the world. And they also did something which has been ongoing for 30 years, at least, which is to make biodiversity and extinction of animals and plants a big deal. So in order to prevent extinction and to maintain biodiversity, nations were expected to restrict the uses of their land and their water. If these were areas where there was a lot of biodiversity, so that and this has been done in Europe. I don't know what's happened in Canada, but the whole map of Europe of the countries who belong to the EU has been designated as either areas to be protected or areas not to be protected, and it looks like it's almost about half and half. And by 2030, 30% of Europe and the United States was supposed to be protected. And by 2050, 50% was supposed to be protected. And that meant that your farm could be designated an area that needs protection. And this would allow the government or possibly some other entity to come in and tell you, oh, you can't do X on your property because it's causing us to lose species. So you may be growing, you know, a monocrop. You can't do that anymore. This area needs to be rewilded. And so people should be aware that areas of Europe and the United States are being rewilded, which means no more grazing, no more crops on those areas. And in the U.S., the government has given farmers who are in dire straits right now, the U.S. has lost 160,000 farms in 7 years since 2017 up until last year, 160,000 farms. We are farming more than 20 million acres less than we were in 2017. So farmers can't make money farming at the moment for a number of reasons, which are some of which are probably deliberate. And so the government has come in and said, we will pay you something if you'll give us an easement on your property, which in the future might restrict the uses of that property. So farmers, desperate for cash, are turning over these easements to the government, which wants to either give them or sell them to NGOs like the Wilderness Society or a National Resources Defense Council, and allow those entities to then determine how the land may be used. So this is another thing that's going on and was part of this whole WHO project, although, you know, everyone was very quiet about it, so people didn't understand what was going on.
With all anyway, these farmers, you know, like losing their livelihoods, like what would balance out this need to protect certain systems with the ability of human beings to eat, you know?
Well, that's it. So the people like Bill Gates and the World Economic Forum and the World Health Organization had a plan. And the director general of the WHO even said, agriculture is causing 30% of greenhouse gases, the release of greenhouse gases. It's causing climate change. And so we need to completely redo the world's food systems. The plan was that basically not much agriculture would go on. Some would, and food would be produced in factories using patented processes. That was the plan. And then if these folks like Bill Gates could gain control of food, they would really, you know, have the population over a barrel.
Wow. So, is there a sense among the various member states that these sorts of things are happening, or is there just something that compels them to go along regardless?
So the meaningful negotiations of these treaties have all been conducted, you know, behind closed doors. So we don't know what they say to each other, but there were 10 drafts of the pandemic treaty that, you know, were written by member states. Some were written by the bureaucracy in the WHO. You know, Bill Gates' people were at the table for some of the negotiations, and they were not accepted. And so finally, a document did get drafted that got rid of all the shalls, all the musts, did not demand nations go along with all the terrible things that the WHO wanted them to go along with, but instead left the framework in place. So left the plan that we're going to roll out vaccines, you know, without clinical trials in 100 days. We're going to monitor misinformation. We're going to create a pathogen access and benefit sharing system, which is a crazy idea that was, I don't know who came up with it, but it's a very evil idea, saying that the World Health Organization would now develop a system, a network of laboratories that would collect and study the most dangerous pathogens, microorganisms in the world. So Ebola, SARS, you know, coronaviruses, many others, would all be sent to WHO laboratories And one draft of the pandemic treaty said that the director general of the WHO would appoint a group of scientists who would oversee gain of function research around the world, presumably.
Yes.
So, yeah. And then they would share these pathogens with nations, with pharmaceutical companies, with research centers. And if drugs or vaccines were developed that could be sold, the nation that supplied the dangerous microorganism would then be given essentially royalties. They would get benefits. Mm. And there was a promise that 10% of, at least 10 to 20% of production of drugs and vaccines by pharmaceutical manufacturers for these dangerous microorganisms would be given to the World Health Organization to be distributed for free or at low cost to poor nations. So not a very, you know, not a very generous offer, but that has been the offer. 10%, maybe up to 20% will be delivered free or at low cost to the WHO for further distribution. Yeah. Meantime, the World Health Organization, even though this never got approved, made its own agreement with the government of Switzerland to create a biohub. Switzerland already had a maximum containment lab, a BSL-4 in Spiez, Switzerland.
Yeah.
And so WHO has basically bought some of that lab and is developing its own collection of dangerous microorganisms right there without the nation states having ever gone along with it.
Well, what would happen if there was something wrong with the vaccine? I mean, how would you, how could the companies be held accountable?
This was part of the treaty, that there would be no accountability. Mm. And they said this in different ways in different drafts. But in one of the drafts, they actually had three paragraphs in a row, each one specifying how companies, manufacturers would not be able to be held responsible. So in one paragraph, it said nations will have to come up with a method of managing liability. In another, it said basically they would be waiving liability. And then they claim they use some other language. But the plan all along has been that in order to roll out a vaccine in 100 days, it can't possibly be tested for safety or efficacy, probably for efficacy either. And so there's a tremendous risk rolling out any of these vaccines, and manufacturers refuse to take that risk. They'll make the vaccines if you want them, just as they did for COVID or for the swine flu in 1976, but they will not accept liability, nor will their insurance companies. And so there either has to be no liability or the government has to take over the liability. And the manufacturers don't care who deals with, you know, they don't care what this plan is as long as they cannot be found liable for injuries. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is a great way to make people sick with vaccines. And if you have a collection of dangerous microorganisms, which is widely shared around the world, and again, in one draft of the pandemic treaty, it actually said, once the WHO has shared these with nation states and manufacturers, these secondary entities who have received the microorganisms can then transfer them to third degree entities. They can then give them out to or sell them to whoever they want. So what this really was
an open source
to disperse and proliferate deadly microorganisms around the world. And then when a pandemic comes, you'll never be able to figure out where it started because all these, you know, different entities have the same microorganism.
Well, from your perspective, I mean, you've talked about biowarfare, and I think that we should take into consideration the whole concept of gain of function and PABS, you know, making sequences available like online or to whoever. You know, some of them, the people, like anyone, I mean, maybe even a hacker or something. And I mean, is this going to...
Exactly. Yeah, thank you for reminding me. So this was another part of many of the drafts of the treaty, which said that not only do nations have to give samples to the WHO, but they have to sequence, that nations were being asked all to set up genetic sequencing laboratories, which is ridiculous. In the middle of Africa, where you can't get a urine specimen or a blood count, you need to build a very high-tech sequencing lab. And then you had to put the sequences of these microorganisms and viruses that you found online, where, of course, hackers can get them. So the whole plan was a dreadful, dreadful plan. And I think, you know, once it really got exposed to the public, it was impossible for them to manage to get it passed. So what they did get passed was a framework that said, these are all the things we want to do, which were the same things they wanted to do earlier, except none of them are forced on nations. So nations don't have to censor, they don't have to send microorganisms, blah, blah, blah. They don't have to do any of it, but the framework is in place. And if the nations do go ahead and ratify this, if they complete it, it's not quite complete because they could not get agreement on the pathogen access and benefit sharing system, which was donating microorganisms to a WHO lab network, and then, if you're lucky, getting some benefits later. That's the PABS system, P-A-B-S, Pathogen Access and Benefit Sharing System. They could not get agreement on that. So they said, we'll put that in a separate annex and we'll add it to the treaty. So what nations did at the end of May was to provisionally adopt the pandemic treaty in its watered down version, with the proviso that it cannot be fully adopted until this PABS annex is part of it, and that has yet to be negotiated. Once it's negotiated, they have to vote on it again, and then nations will have to ratify the document before it's actually able to be enforced and go into force.
Mm. So is there like a window in time where people could, reverse the damage or some of the damage being brought about by this agreement?
Yes. So what the WHO is hoping is that they will negotiate the PABS agreement over the next year. There are yearly meetings of the members of the World Health Organization, which is called the World Health Assembly. And they're hoping that by next May, they will have the PABS agreement in place. They will vote on the entire pandemic treaty. And then nations will have a period of time to ratify. They will need to go through, because it's a treaty, they have to go through a formal ratification. And then a month after 60 nations have ratified, that treaty will go into force. So we have at least a year to get rid of this PABS annex and say that the proliferation of biological weapons, which is really what these dangerous microorganisms are, goes against other international law, such as the Biological Weapons Convention, and something that was put forward at the UN Security Council, and say that, you know, that the proliferation of biological weapons is not something the world's people want. And we need to get rid of this, and ideally get rid of the WHO, because it's a completely captured agency that really, is a net negative value to the world. It does a few good things and it does a lot of bad things. And I think we need to end it and start fresh with a clean slate and be very clear that the World Health Organization, any new health organization, a global health organization, will not have any ability to give orders to nations or create pathogen access and benefit sharing systems or any of this other nonsense. You know, we need to get rid of the idea of One Health, which was designed to take much of the world and put it into the health basket so it could be managed by the World Health Organization. So those are the things that need to happen. The United States is already there. Argentina has also said it's getting out of the WHO. So it'd be ideal if many other countries exit the WHO or stop paying their dues and just say, look, we no longer find this organization to be of value to our nation.
Mm.
And it's a threat.
Yeah, well, I just want to get you maybe correspond to something that I heard recently. There was a fellow who was talking about in negative, very negative terms about the WHO, and then he said it's worse than that. It's actually a criminal cartel, given the way they've been dispensed. I mean, we mentioned that it was a private public private partnership, but you did mention that they did some good, they did do some good things, but as you said, they've got to be completely overhauled and so on. Do you see it as a criminal cartel, or is that a little, is that pushing things a bit?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know what the definition of a criminal cartel is. I would say that the way these documents have been negotiated, the nations of the global South have been very unhappy. The negotiations have been taken over by the bureaucracy within the WHO. The Bill Gates people have managed to weasel their way in officially, even. So they are stakeholders, and they, as they and the Wellcome Trust people, did a lot of management of how the COVID pandemic was to be handled throughout the world. The same thing is happening. These private funders are having a lot of influence over what comes out of the WHO. For instance, even after everybody knew that COVID, the SARS-CoV-2 could be transmitted via aerosol. So if you were in a room with someone, even though you weren't within 6 feet, but if you were in a closed room with someone that you could catch it from them, it took like a year and a half for the WHO to admit that, because they're, the people behind the WHO did not want to admit that. They wanted a different story. They also didn't want you to know that when you were walking outside, you weren't going to catch it. Unless someone, spit in your face, it was almost impossible to catch it, because there's a breeze and things are, the air is being diluted very much. So, because, and Bill Gates has been the biggest donor to the UN. Certainly when the US pulled out, during the end of Trump's first administration, Bill Gates was the biggest donor to the UN. The UK and Germany have also been large donors. But if you add Gavi and CEPI, which are organizations that Bill Gates founded, to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, most years Bill Gates is the WHO's biggest donor. He also has managed to get himself diplomatic immunity. And for all his Gavi officials in Switzerland, the country where the WHO is located and where Gavi is centered, he and all his high staff have been given diplomatic immunity because of these donations. So if he were to be accused of a crime in the US, he could get on his private plane, fly to Switzerland, and they would not be able to touch him.
I'll have to call it there. Thank you so much for your tremendous efforts, both as a medical practitioner and as a communicator on these very crucial issues.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's always great to be with you. I love global research.
Dr. Meryl Nass was trained as an independent internal medicine physician, and she's an activist with expertise in anthrax and bioterrorism. And her websites are Meryl Nass. Substack.com and DoorToFreedom.org.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show can air on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download on the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.